Hello, I'm Rory McKiernan, author of Hitching for Hope and host of the Love and Courage podcast. And you're very welcome to this, the Creative Souls of Clare podcast. We've a great episode for you coming up in just a moment. Before we get started, can I encourage you, when you're finished this episode, be sure to check out the archives of the podcast. Lots of great conversations in there waiting for you to enjoy. And a big thanks to all of you for the support with the podcast in so many different ways, and to Creative Ireland Clare for their support. My guest in this episode is Matthew Noon. Matthew is an Australian-Irish ex-indie rocker, improviser, composer, thinker and performer, originally from Brisbane and now living in East Clare. He's particularly well known for his devotion to Indian classical music, which he brings to a range of disciplines, including Irish trad music, traditional music, free improvisation, electro-acoustic music, and so much more. Matthew is also a scholar with a PhD to his name, and he recently took up the role of Director of World Music, the World Music Programme at the Irish World Academy of Music and Dance at the University of Limerick. He's a fascinating fella with some great insights and stories, as you're about to hear. So let's get going with this Creative Souls of Clare conversation with Matthew Noon. Matthew, you're very, very welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
Doing very good, thanks, Rory. Yourself?
Really good. It's autumn time here and the winds are starting to kick up in Lahinch, but it's beautiful parts of the world, but the wind's definitely sturdy old tempers. I'm like starting to get a bit, you know, gets in on you.
Yeah,
this is, you asked me how I am and now I'm going into a therapy podcast about the wind.
this is a safe space for you.
Yeah, it's funny, you know. I sometimes give out about Irish people saying, you know, we ask each other how we doing, how are you, and we never really answer. You just, the agreement is you just go grand and get on with it. But like you, I often don't start a podcast with that question, and you ask me how am I doing. I decided to go into the whole thing. The wind is doing my head in. Anyway, you're in East Clare. You're well sheltered.
Yeah, we're in the hills of the Slievochtys, you know, the rolling gentle hills. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a nice place as long as they don't start doing too much mining up there. I hear there's So listen, Matthew, tell me a little bit about yourself, and you know, obviously we'll get to how you ended up in Clare, but you're a man immersed in music, and I actually first encountered you in I was living in Dublin for a number of years, and I can't even remember the gig, but you definitely were part of a gig in the Sugar Club. I've no idea what it was, or was it a fundraiser or something or other. But anyway, you definitely made a mark, and that I remembered your name. And then I've seen you popping up here and there. You're one of these guys that pops up a lot.
Like a mushroom.
Maybe. Magic mushroom. Maybe just tell me a little bit about yourself and your journey in music and where it all began.
Right. Well, I was born and reared in Brisbane in the east coast of Australia, and started as a guitar player, actually, classical guitar. And then I discovered Hendrix. And my best friends, I just remembered this now, when you asked me where did it all start. My best friends, when I turned 13, my birthday, they all pitched in like $10. And I bought my first guitar with birthday money from like 10 of my mates, you know.
Wow.
Yeah. Pretty fucking cool, huh?
That's pretty good buddies to have.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
So it was guitar, rock, indie rock, grunge, you know, mid-90s stuff.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I guess, and so, but I was never really a guitar player as such. I was never really, you know, into guitar solos, or it was just the instrument, any instrument I played. And I was always sort of pushing at the edges of whatever I was doing, like what's slightly more experimental, you know. So I eventually got into post-rock and electronic stuff and free jazz and drumming, and then I just got into everything that I was kind of interested in. And West African drumming at one point, hip-hop, country music. And then, yeah, the shortish version of the story is that then I went to India in 2003, and had kind of given up on being a musician. I kind of went there on a Buddhist pilgrimage, and but music was definitely something that was still core to, you know, keeping the flame of my inspiration alive. And so, yeah, just through circumstance, I actually met my teacher by accident on a ferry crossing the Ganges. I know it sounds like I made it up, but and I hadn't really gone to learn music, but I had become a bit disenfranchised with the spiritual quest that I was on. Wasn't quite bearing the fruits that I had hoped. And so I just kind of had this chance meeting with this amazing musician in Calcutta, and he was a sarod player, which is the instrument that I mainly play now, which is a North Indian lute. And so for about 6 years, I was just obsessed with Indian music, not Indian classical music, and I was spending a lot of time in India, sort of half the year, trying to learn how to play Indian classical music. And then eventually found my way back to Ireland, which is where my dad's from. So I sort of settled here in the West. And still a sarod player. But most people kind of know me now for playing other things other than Indian music on the sarod, which is kind of what I do since I moved here. I got into playing Irish traditional music and then, you know, my own stuff now. So that's sort of how I came to the sarod and what I do now.
Wow, that's quite the journey.
I guess it is, yeah.
So if you just go back a little bit to when you went on that pilgrimage to India, and, you know, I think you talked about being disenfranchised, well, certainly disenfranchised with the spiritual part of the journey that you were on eventually, but it also sounded like you were disenfranchised with whatever was going on in music, you know, that you, what was that? Was that like, was that sort of a traditional playing in bands and then trying to get a label and, or, and then eventually you go, oh, what's it all about kind of thing? Or,
I guess I was this was in the mid 90s when indie rock and grunge was sort of big, and, you know, Nirvana were like the mainstream, and I was playing in bands and, some level of commercial success was always sort of seen as the goal, you know, even if at the same time having creative autonomy and keeping true to yourself. So that we never really had to compromise that. That was never really part of the agenda, but still, it was still that being in a capitalist framework, and not just capitalism, but being in a framework where music is something that's about, that where the reward is something external to their music itself. I became really disenfranchised with that more so than the music, and also just the scene of rock and roll, and I mean, I still love a lot of indie rock and post rock, and but just, I don't know, the urbanness, the alcohol, the drugs, the sort of, I mean, it's also the fun part of it, but also sort of the dark side of it, you know, and sort of the misogyny and sort of macho-ness, particularly in Australia, you know, that whole pub scene just, it didn't really ever sit well with me, you know? And so that's why I sort of fell out of that world. And then I never really fell into another world. I was searching for some other world to fall into. But I didn't know it at the time, but it was only after I sort of found Indian music, and only years after, not that I found it, but after falling into Indian music, it was already there. I didn't find it. But after falling into it, years later, I guess I realized, you know, that what I was looking for was a music that was sort of a complete music that was sort of like spiritual, cultural, a lifestyle, traditional, had this sense of tradition weight to it, but also free, you know, incredible freedom, great creativity, and also a great openness for your own expression, you know. And so, yeah, so my encounter with Indian music was like the first one. I was like, oh, here we go. Okay, this is something that's got something going on, you know. I want to kind of go in here as deep as I can. So I guess that's what the disenfranchisement of the music was, that I guess the cultural framework that I had growing up in you know, urban Australia. I don't know if that answers your question.
No, absolutely. And then did that ultimately lead you to, or just coincide with, the quest element of going to India? Like, were you actively getting involved in Buddhism, or was it just like, I'm just going to experiment and see what's happening over here? Or were you, you know, quite serious about it?
Oh yeah, no, I forgot about that part. Yeah, so actually, before I went to India, I actually gave up playing music altogether. I got into Buddhism through the work of John Cage, the composer. And he uses a lot of Zen anecdotes for his sort of compositional techniques. And it was through that, like, I kind of kept, like I was saying, kept experimenting, and then I got into experimental Western music and the stuff, John Cage stuff. And that's when I first encountered Zen and this whole idea of sort of deconstructing that we actually have any power over the world or music, that we are the authors of music in a sense, and that and also the beautiful thing about Zen and Cage sort of touches into this is that it's all about just listening, you know, and like the realizing the richness of sounds that we're surrounded with constantly. So that's what sort of led me to Zen. And yeah, I'd stopped gigging, actually. I'd stopped playing music altogether. And I took Buddhist lay vows when I was 25. And I was really into it for about 5 years. I get a bit obsessed by things.
Yeah.
So I threw myself into Zen for a few years in Sydney, actually. I was living in the outskirts of Sydney, in the Blue Mountains near Sydney. And I had a teacher, and I was like going to my Sangha every Friday night and going to 10-day retreats, silent retreats, and doing all the chanting in Japanese and banging gongs and hanze yon cha no uno. And so I wasn't really even interested in playing music anymore. And that's how I got the idea for a pilgrimage, because one of the chants in the Zen tradition, it talks about the five sort of holy places of the Buddha: Lumbini, Kusinagara, Sarnath, Bodh Gaya, a couple of Atsu. Is those five? It's like where he was born, where he was enlightened, where he first started teaching, where he died. I can't remember what the other one is, but there's five places anyway. So I kind of just, in my mid-20s, 26, I think, I got just disenfranchised with my life at that point, and was like, okay, I'm just going to go to India. And I didn't want to just go and just, you know, backpack around and go to Goa, and, you know, I wanted to have a purpose. So the pilgrimage was a way to sort of, guide my way around India.
Mm. Nice. I don't mean nice. Nice is such a non-word in some sense, but it strikes me as a remarkable thing to do in your mid-20s, as opposed to at just a critical age, you know, because it's you know, where the path kind of splits. You could go down any number of roads, and it really sounds like there was a, you know, almost all this sense of giving up and surrendering and disillusionment or disenchantment, and then here's this dude on the ferry, and suddenly things just radically change. And I wouldn't be talking to you perhaps because, other than this guy you met on the ferry, you know. You just don't know when those moments are going to come.
It's definitely like been the defining road path choice of my life, you know, so far. I think was that trip to India, I kind of had a sense. I knew I was going for a reason, but I didn't know what it was, you know. I had this pull to go to India for a long time, had really just surrendered to just seeing where it led me. And I thought it was going to be 6 months meditating in a temple and becoming enlightened, but didn't work out that way.
And so what did the years after that look like then? Where did you end up? Did you go back to Australia or did you wander onwards?
Yeah, I met a bunch of other foreigners who'd been learning Indian classical music for a few years. You know, I had just started, and I was really lucky to sort of meet this kind of motley crew of weird outcasts, a bit like me, who just decided to get into Indian music. Mm. And a few of them had been doing it for 4 or 5 years. And through meeting a few people like that from all over the world, I realized, oh, I could do this. This could be a thing I do. I could just, you know, go back home, work part-time, do any bit of job I can, save a few grand, and come back to India for as long as the money lasts and study with my teacher and just study full-time, you know, sort of self-funded study, really, because it's really cheap to stay in. You can live really cheap in India for a long period. And then go back to Australia and come back and just do that, you know, because I knew straight away, okay, this isn't a, you know, 8 week course and you're going to master Indian music. Yeah. This is like a life. And I also knew not just a life journey, but I knew I had to spend some serious time in India, you know, and sort of put in a lot of hard graft and practice, just especially at the initial point, because there was so much unlearning to do, you know. So through luckily meeting this really interesting community of people, I sort of managed to do that for 5, 6, 7 years or so, sort of not really living anywhere, you know, sort of being in India half the year and then Australia, and then I would go to Europe in the summers sometimes. We'll busk a little bit across Europe. My teacher would go to Europe for concerts, so I used to sort of follow him through across Europe, which was amazing. It was my first time, apart from Ireland, you know, going to places like France and Spain and Denmark, and you know, with my guru was pretty wild. And then I used to always come back to Galway because my aunt lives in Frobo, and my dad's family are they're from Galway, and so there's some of them still out in the west coast. So I used to come. I used to busk in Galway, great busking town in the summer. And so that went on for 6 or 7 years like that. And then I kind of got tired of that lifestyle of sort of not really living anywhere and living out of a backpack and not wearing any underwear. And
to know all the details.
Okay, it's not that kind of podcast. So I got tired of it eventually, and then I had the feeling like, yeah, I need to have roots, I need to have a home, you know. So, and Ireland always felt like home because of my dad's Irish, and he always talked about it as home. So it just felt like the place to come and settle, you know.
That's interesting. And was music in your dad's family or in his life? Did you grow up with music with him, or?
Nobody played music, but my dad's a great connoisseur of music. He loves music, and he has a great record collection, which I would have listened to when I was very young. I remember being 5 or 6 and getting up early and sneaking down to the den where the records were, putting on like Leonard Cohen and, you know, Stones records and these Beatles records that my dad, Nina Simone. And
did you say when you were 5 or 6?
Yeah, maybe not 5 or 6, 6 or 7.
Wow, that's pretty good.
Yeah, not 5 or 6. Yeah. But it was early primary school. I remember getting up and like putting on my dad's records and listening to them. Like, yeah, so that had a really big impact on me. And my dad isn't musical in that sense, but he really passed on to me that beautiful, that beautiful way you can appreciate music in a total emotional experience. You know, like when he listens and talks about music, it's like you can see it's just like straight to something deep in him. You know? And I really saw that and felt that with him. It's like when he talked and listened to music, it was something that was really meaningful, you know? Mm. And so music always was something I felt was really special. Mm. You know? kind of magic.
Mm. So clearly there's a great kind of lineage and heritage there for your family and your links to Galway and so on. But did you ever at any point, or do you ever feel sort of split between lands or countries, or how does that feel to be an immigrant essentially, or you are and you aren't, like the Irish, there's a global Irishness that has multiple shades, but yet, you know, you are raised in another land.
Yeah, I used to feel more split about it. I don't, as I get older, I don't, you know. I kind of feel like I'm Irish, but I kind of feel like I'm Australian too. And
yeah,
that's kind of cool. Like, you know,
I'm kind of happy
with that.
Yeah, there's a few of you about, you know, I'm sure Steve Cooney's name enters the mix a lot. And yeah, but like that, you know, there's, as I said, shades of Irishness and versions of it, and people, Irish people with English accents and American accents and all sorts. And the more the merrier, and the more shades the better as well, because it also brings all these different stories home, and sort of the Irish music goes away and it comes back again, and then it picks up a bit of Indian classical guitar on the way and so on, through Leonard Cohen and so on. Yeah. So Galway is clearly in the mix, and, you know, Galway is just a skip to Clare. So was it that you fell over the border one day, or you got pulled or pushed?
I fell over and fell into a fairy ring and I couldn't get out.
That's, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah. What was it with Clare? Oh, I got a job actually in Ennis Diamond, in the Steiner School there.
All right. Yeah, I know it well.
Yeah, in Mullinoiga, and back in 2007 or 2008. And that's what drew me to Clare, because I used to be a primary school teacher for years in Australia. And yeah, so that was the pull. So I lived in and around that part of North Clare for about 4 or 5 years. I was teaching in Ennis Diamond. So that was my first pulled to the place, and I had some friends who were living in the borough, and before I got the job in Ennis Diamond, I had a few friends in that part of the world, and I just loved it and felt loved the wildness and this is a real dynamic vibrancy around people of Clare, and there's also a lot of blow-ins too, you know, like me, so there's a real nice mix of people. So yeah, that was, I guess, what drew me to Clare. And then when my partner at the time and I, we bought a house, we wanted somewhere that was sort of, I was sort of also based in Limerick at the time, starting to go, I went back to university and she was in Galway. So we wanted somewhere in between. So Clare was, that was the good catchment. So that's how we ended up in East Clare then. And I particularly wanted to move to East Clare because of the strong tradition of music there. Even though I wasn't playing Irish music at the time, but I had this feeling of like music is really alive here. It's like humming, you know, it's humming in the place. So that was a real draw for me, for Clare. Yeah.
It's a great way of putting it, humming. It's real evocative. So it wasn't long before you bumped into Tommy Hayes, or had you crossed paths before?
No, I actually, it was when I moved to East Clare and I met Tommy. I mean, I know Tommy's music since I was a teenager, actually.
Okay.
I remember a Stockton's Wing cassette, you know, and I used to love that cassette. I used to play it to death. And I love Stockton's Wing and Planxty and the Bahi Band, particularly. Like for me, that's like, it's like rock trad, like the energy of it is really like,
yeah,
it's hard, like, and like the beards and the hair,
yeah, it's
like,
gritty,
yeah,
it's indie trad.
It's kind of like indie trad, yeah, like for me as a indie rocker, you know, it was like looking at an image of Stockton's Wing and, like, you know, and Sonic Youth, and like there was like this, they're equally as cool, you know.
Well, you know, yeah, and then like the Clancy's hanging out with Bob Dylan and all that. There's probably a beatnik shade in there somewhere too, but
I think definitely, and there's a bit of radical thinking, and I think in that era of traditional music, there was definitely a lot of radical thinking,
the so-called revival, or
So I didn't meet Tommy until I moved to East Clare, and I used to do these these all-night concerts, house concerts in my home.
All night?
Yeah. It was for Saraswati Puja. Saraswati is the Indian goddess of creativity, and she's often associated with music. She often is depicted with a big veena, you know. So that tradition exists in Calcutta. I experienced that when I was living in Calcutta. And so I wanted to keep it going when I moved to Ireland. So I just would invite any Indian musicians I knew, and then any musicians I knew, because, you know, you need to have a lot of people to have music the whole night, you know. I knew Tommy was living locally, and I just thought, I have to invite him to one of these pujas. So I just invited him, you know, and he didn't know me from Adam. And he came along, and then I remember we just started playing, and then we played for hours and hours, and it was just we just both really enjoyed it, you know.
Right.
We're like, yeah, we should do more of this. This is fun, you know. So that's how it started. Yeah, and that was 10 years ago now. We're playing 10 years together.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah. Wow, it's interesting how all the mixes get mixed up and make the magic. And so we mentioned the puja and so on, but and obviously it's in the music, but does that imply that you have to some degree sort of moved from Zen, you know, the Japanese Zen tinge, but then you sort of left that and you took on maybe some of the Indian. I'm basically wondering, are you a Vedic practitioner, or like in terms of Vedic?
No, I'm. I don't know what I am.
Okay. Yeah.
No, I'm not. I'm not a yoga guy. I'm not. I'm not really a, you know, Ayurvedic guy. I don't. I mean, I do a bit of everything, but I'm not really. I'm not really precious about any of it. You know.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's like, it's part of who I am, but I'm not very dogmatic about it. You know, it's kind of just my own rituals that just make sense for me. And it's a mixture. Like, I still meditate. I still have my Zen practice. That's still really valuable to me. And I'm not like very strict. Sometimes I don't meditate all the time, but then sometimes I'm like, hey, I needed to start meditating again regularly. And I sit a lot. I'm still in contact with my teacher, my Zen teacher. And yeah, and the Indian stuff for me is really connected to the music. So the spiritual aspect of it, and, you know, the Indian deities and the rituals and prayers. So a lot of that I've adopted for me is really connected to the music, you know. And it's, I don't think you can learn Indian music without some appreciation of that, and some acknowledgement of that. I think it's sort of part and parcel of the music. But I wouldn't actually be drawn to that spiritual practice without the music, you know, like in terms of as a religious practice. For me, it's something that religious practice is tied in with my musical practice, if that makes sense.
Yeah, very interesting. Do you find out your music is still evolving? I mean, I'm sure it is, but is there any particular evolution occurring, and any, you know, are you heading towards jazz anytime soon or anything?
Yeah, well, you're not going to believe this, but it is evolving. I'm actually about to release a new solo album. I've made a couple of solo albums, but the next one is actually an entire album of ukulele.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. Didn't see that coming.
The guy keeps throwing the plot twists.
Yeah, no, ukulele album and songs, actually. Yeah. That's... ukulele and songs but I mean, when I say ukulele album, it's pretty out there, you know. It's not tiptoe through the tulips.
It's psychedelic uke.
Yeah, maybe that's we could call it that. I started playing the tenor ukulele a few years ago. I had an injury to my left hand and I couldn't play sarod for a few months, and I was going a bit crazy, so I just started fiddling around with it. I tuned it down so it was like a sarod, you know, and started messing around with it. And I just really enjoyed the freedom and also the creative challenge of playing another different instrument, and just different kinds of tunes and songs started coming out. So yeah, we're doing that for a few years, and I've done bits and pieces of uke, but I actually got some Arts Council funding to sort of do a deep dive and just focus on, like, okay, how far could I push this boat out. So yeah, I've gone and made an album. It's going to come out in a couple of weeks. Nothing but ukulele and voice and...
Well, stuff. Nothing wrong with it. Eddie Vedder. Can be done. It's just, I guess it as an instrument tends to get this other stereotype associated with it. I guess it's somewhere between like really deep Hawaiian stuff and kind of happy Californian hippie vibes. But it's versatile, so it's not surprising that you would kind of take it and make it your own as well. So,
yeah. I think any instrument, any instrument is like has its limitations, and that's sort of the beauty of learning a new instrument. Like I like challenging myself, and I like having limitations. You know, I kind of don't like it when I have no limitations, you know, placed on me. And there's something really enjoyable about being an absolute beginner at something again. You know, it's like, oh, and there's something fresh and exciting and about discovering, well, what can I do? And because I'm not approaching it, I'm not trying to play ukulele as a ukulele player. I'm just like, how can I make music that feels good for me with this thing I have in my hands, you know? And part of that was also like part of my journey with the Sarod part of it was trying to get deep into Indian music, but also at some point, I guess I realized that, particularly when I came back to university and started thinking about what it meant to be a white guy playing Indian music, you know, and I felt that's definitely a really valuable thing to do. But I also wondered, you know, like, could I make music beyond just playing Indian classical music? Because that's also like, that's part of what I do, but it's not entirely who I am, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I guess like where you have popped up on my radar in recent years, I do associate you now as the Indian music guy.
And right. Yeah.
Yeah. But there's a lot more going on clearly.
Yeah. That kind of is like what I mostly do. And it definitely has been the biggest influence on my life, I would say, not just musical life, but but also I think it's good to go away from it too and come back to it. And I found that's really beneficial. Partly that's why I got into the Irish traditional music, because I had a different instrument made just for playing Irish music. And I found actually that was really beneficial to my Indian classical playing, because I could totally go away from it and play something on a different instrument. And then when I came back to Indian music, it was like fresh again. It was like, oh, I'm coming back to this again with fresh ears again.
Yeah. You know? I guess that's what like a lot of the Planxty and Donal Lunny and, you know, a lot of Steve Cooney is like, bringing in those other influences and freshening it up a bit. And obviously there are people of a more Puritan nature that aren't overly happy when that happens, but everything has its place. Like, it's good to keep things pure as well. And then on the other hand, it's good to stir the pot and add some spice and flavors here and there.
Yeah. Curry chips. That's what Tommy used to call what we do. he wanted to call the band Curry Chips when we first started. I was like, no, it can't be Curry Chips.
Curry chips.
I was the curry. I was the curry and he was the potatoes, you know?
Oh, that's gas. Yeah, it still could happen.
maybe that'll be a side project.
Tell him not to give up the dream. So you've mentioned university a couple of times, and I think you've got links. I'm not totally sure, but is it links with the World Music Academy or is it? Yeah.
Yeah, I came back and did my master's and PhD here a few years ago, and then I've just sort of hung around like a bad smell since then. And eventually, yeah, they gave me a job eventually. So I just took over from Mel Mercier to run the BA in World Music. So I'm the director of World Music now, which is pretty cool.
It's a great title, isn't it? I'm the director of World Music.
Like my cousin was saying, it's like that Pinky in the Brain episode. What are we going to do tonight? Try and take over the world of music.
Yeah, yeah. You're in charge of world music now the world. Great.
All the music in the world.
Have you managed then, like, obviously it's music in an academic setting, but presumably there's an emphasis on the music, but academia has a way of kind of putting its paws and claws on things. And I'm wondering, like, are you clearly are comfortable and competent in academia, whereby you've navigated a master's and a PhD, so you've managed to, you know, not lose your mind at that. And now you're like, at what point are you now an academic versus a musician, and or are you hybrid, or what how do you see all that?
I describe myself as an artist scholar. That's the term.
Yeah, scholar is probably a better way than academic. Yeah.
And I mean, the academy is a really cool place. So this, and Mihola Sulavom was an incredible visionary, who, and his light still shines here, you know. And he had this vision of, you know, the artist and the scholar sort of working hand in hand, or actually that the artist is a scholar and the scholar is an artist, that they're not contradictions, you know. And he was a wonderful living example of that, you know, and how those two sides of ourselves and those two sort of roles can really speak to each other and really enhance each other. So I've been very lucky to be in a space where the idea of playing music and the idea of thinking and talking about music are not poles apart. They're actually seen as really valuable bedfellows, I guess.
Yeah, and it's clear, obviously, as you said, his imprint is all over it, and that it was ultimately the Academy was founded by a musician primarily. And but there is something in that that kind of art, the art of scholarship, if it is an art in its own right. And it certainly seems to be very well regarded in terms of, you know, musical institutions globally. It has a reputation, so it's great that you've managed to keep all your various threads together as well. Like, there's no kind of, don't detect any great disharmony in it. You know, there's a lot of harmony in the journey, if you like. And even, you know, you're in Limerick, you're in Clare, the Galway, your father, and it sounds like you're arriving into a really good zone at the moment.
Yeah, feels like it. Yeah, I try not to think about it too much.
Maybe don't think about it too much.
But no, I definitely feel like, I mean, yeah, it feels like a lot of things are coming together at the moment, which is really, really satisfying. And yeah, I feel like all the parts of myself are getting really nourished at the same time, you know, which is really nice. And also I have lots of avenues for the parts of myself I want to express, because I love performing, and I love playing indie music as much as I love playing Irish music. And I also love writing and reading about music, and I love teaching. I love talking about music, you know, I love talking about any kind of music, you know? I think that all feeds into all the different parts, you know, and I like the talking and thinking about music really feeds into the non-intellectual just playing of music, I think, you know?
I think those
ideas and conversations and thoughts we have about music really feed into, you know, our bodies and how we express music too.
Would you ever consider getting back on the indie rock saddle at all?
I guess the ukulele album is kind of leaning back into that world a little bit.
Yeah.
I was always really into, they used to call it lo-fi rock and stuff when I was a teenager. You ever heard of Lou Barlow, a band called Sebado? I was really into that sort of stuff in the mid-90s. And it's kind of a punk ethos where you just
Is it anywhere near Mazzy Star? No.
Oh, big fan of Mazzy Star. No,
not quite.
Not quite as polished and melodic as Mazzy Star.
Okay.
It's sort of a punk ethos of just, you know, making up music on your own in a room with a 4-track cassette player, you know, 4-track recorder, and just sort of having no limits, or having some limitations in terms of having rough and ready recording material and whatever instruments you have, and then just going for it, you know. And I like that. I like that.
Yeah, I got
energy.
Yeah. Nico, no.
Nico, yeah, maybe that.
Nico Lou Reed, somewhere in the region. Anyway, I'm yeah. trying to get with my references, but I kind of get what you're saying about like the ethos. It's a good ethos because it's really empowering in that it gives you sort of there are some fundamentals and boundaries there, but it is basically playful and just like get on with it, see what happens. Has a kind of garage basement vibe. Yeah. And I suppose that thing that does leave a lot of people disillusioned is this primer around what does success look like. And it's a distorted view that a lot of particularly young folk getting involved in music are guided down a kind of a false road of, you know, what it's all about in terms of the enjoyment and the pleasure and the gift of music. And it's sad then when a lot do give it up, whereas it could be a lifelong journey.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for not aspiring for greatness, but just aspiring to express yourself, you know.
Yeah.
And I like that, particularly that sort of indie rock lo-fi world. I like that unpolishedness because it kind of feels human, you know. Like I like that imperfectness because we're imperfect. Humans are imperfect, you know. And that's why I'm generally drawn towards folk music or music that has sort of some rough edges, you know, because that's kind of who we are.
Well, as you can see from the beginning of this podcast, I'm a very imperfect kind of guy. I was like, shit, I'm digging a massive hole for myself. I might as well just roll with it here. It's like, yeah, I often do that. It's like, you know, it's podcasting or any other thing. It's this idea that we're supposed to be this or that rather than just whatever way it rolls. And the more you kind of lean into the authentic expression, you sort of find your own groove with it. And obviously you don't want to make a complete mess in the process as well. But sometimes you need the freedom to allow yourself to make the mess. Yeah. That's the thing, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, a constant journey to be, it's kind of about being vulnerable, isn't it? You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what being vulnerable is like being okay with sort of being a mess sometimes, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Getting it wrong or, you know?
Yeah. It's like when your curry chips go on the floor. I'm just going to roll with the curry chips.
Yeah, we're going to try and go with this metaphor. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So, Matthew, as we conclude, I know you have to go soon, but is there anything else you feel like needs expressing at this point in your life? Speak now.
Jeez, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think so, no. Just, yeah, I mean, I'm not sure what the point of your podcast is. I know it's like people from Clare and sort of,
I'm not sure what the point of it is. you're just outing me, you know. It's a complete excuse for me to just chat to people about things I'm interested in. But yeah, it's broadly like Creative Souls of Clare. Generally speaking, people who are in or from Clare, there's a creative bent in there somewhere, which is a broad palette. And I just talk to them about their lives. And so that's what you've just done.
Okay, I've done that. So
And I try and avoid, you know, give me your top 10 tips for how to be creative, because I tend to find that everyone's going to have 10 different tips a lot of the time, you know.
Right, yeah.
It's kind of finding your own path along the way. And I think you've definitely a testimony to that you've have quite a unique journey, but everyone's journey is unique. Like Tommy Hayes is going to be different than someone else's and so on. And it's great now that you're involved in education or have been, well, you've always been involved in education as a teacher. So your teaching background is still cooking there, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really valuable. I love teaching actually. And I loved teaching primary school for a period. I really love working with young kids, but it feels really satisfying now to sort of take that energy and some of those skills that I've acquired and to bring them to something that I'm really, really, that makes, to go back to this idea of makes all of me sing, you know, like my whole body sings. Like when I have to go into a lecture and talk to some kids about, you know, Indian music or not even Indian music, you know, I mean, even this week, just the diversity of the students. So they had a Ukrainian student, a Russian student, a Nigerian student, we have students from like Castle Troy, someone from Milton Malby, some American students. And it's like, okay, like what's this thing called world music? What's imperialism? What like, how does, you know, it's like just the discussions you can have out of that, you know, it's really satisfying just to think that, to think that you could have some little bit of influence over young, you know, young adults in their, in development of their creative minds is just such an honor, you know? So yeah, I'm really grateful for that, for the space that I have.
Brilliant. Well, they're lucky to have you. Yeah, onwards and upwards, and good luck with the good luck with running the music of the world.
All the music of the world. Yeah. No pressure.
Yeah. Thanks, Matthew. Thanks for the chat. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks, Rory. Yeah, pleasure.
Hello, Rory McKiernan here again. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Creative Souls of Clare podcast. Please do consider sharing it amongst friends and people you think might be interested and help it get out into the world, reach more people. And don't forget to check out the archive for more great conversations. A big thanks also to Creative Ireland Clare for their support. And remember, I have another podcast you might enjoy. It's called the Love and Courage podcast. Some great conversations in there also. You can find me, Rory McKiernan, on various social media platforms and over at rorymckiernan.com. That's it, folks. Thanks for listening. Until next time.